Good afternoon, my brothers and sisters. How are you?
Good.
You doing well? You shout at me. What was that? I still love you. The ushers are going to come forward. If you came prepared to partner financially with what God is up to in and through this crazy, wonderful group of people, that's what the bag with handles on it going by, that's what that's about. It's a way of entrusting ourselves and unifying ourselves to each other and to God. And so that's one of the ways. It's an important way. So that's what that is about. While they're doing that, we're going to wrap up a series entitled Humus. We're not discussing smashed chickpeas. We're talking about it. That's hummus. That was a really funny joke. Trust me. Humus. It's organic soil from which we get the word human, where we get the word humble or humility, and when necessary, where we get humiliation. That's God keeping our feet on the ground, not to shame us, but because we're human, and sometimes we forget that, or sometimes we have different expectations on others that go beyond the scope of humanity. And so humility is a way that God keeps us connected to what we really are so that we can remember what we're not. And so our expectations can be really, really healthy. I've got a friend that said he was going to sit up here really quick. Hey, come on up here real quick. You don't have to do anything. Just this shirt was so great that I wanted you to... Oh, no, no, no. You're going to unzip that. You're going to show... Come on. Come on up here. Are you shy? Come on. Go for it.
Okay.
So we're talking about humility. The shirt says, I can't hear you over the sound of how epic I am. So pay really close attention today, all right?
Okay.
Let's give him a hand. He's expecting it. Oh, he's just saying what we all think. Yeah, talking about humility, talking about being humble, and what is that? And it connecting us to our humanity. It's a gift to us that God exalts the humble, but humbles the self-exalted. And so we're going to wrap up the series, a four-week series today. Sometimes people give reviews on churches, and they do it publicly, do it on the internet. Now, sometimes you just get a message directly, an email or something, and somebody saying that they liked something or had questions or whatever, that's all fine. But sometimes people, they write reviews publicly about churches, and sometimes they do it about Crosspoint. And I could go for quite a while on just talking about culturally and sociologically what that is, that we come from a culture that's very consumeristic, and so unfortunately the church has become part of product review. It makes sense you'd do that at Jiffy Lube, you know? But when you're talking about the thing that Jesus died for, when we're talking about family and all the different backgrounds that come and sometimes collide together, trying to live a life of faith, it's not an evil thing. Sometimes it's just like, oh, let's leave our reviews for Burger King, who promised that we'd get it our way. The church, let's treat it differently. But I digress. I understand it. I don't get it, and I get it at the same time. What helps is when the review is positive. Then I've got nothing to say, right? Like this woman, who this is on their internet about Crosspoint. Love, 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 all caps three times. That's how you know she means it. Crosspoint. We were with our first church in Florida for 5 years before we decided to move to North Carolina. The thought of finding another church that we love seemed daunting. We visited Crosspoint, and wow, in all caps, it was exactly what we were looking for. The music is rockin', no G. Tons of young families, extensive childcare. The messages are right on point with an E. Are you kidding? That's adorable. Now, see, this is you, okay? The congregation just exudes spiritual maturity. And there are tons of opportunities to get involved to help out within the church or the community. You can just tell that the people of this church really love each other and welcome others. That's you. Good job. That's your review, all right? How many of you know there's a left hook coming? I don't want to disappoint. So the very next review on the thing that Jesus died for says this. The reviews saying that this church, Crosspoint, is clicky are completely correct, in all caps. If you're a newcomer, they have no newcomer, they have no problem welcoming your check at collection time, but you don't expect much of a welcome beyond that. I disagree with another reviewer who says this church is involved in the community. They pump you for money for causes in Haiti and other countries, plural, yet I have never heard them speak of any local community involvement or charity work. This seems like a profit machine. Quick one-hour service, which is mostly rock music, one collection, sometimes two. Mm-hmm. You guys are so uncomfortable right now. I love this. Especially you, sir. Why did he keep coming? Sometimes too, then out the door without so much of a thank you for coming. This church is definitely divided into cliques. If you're not on the inside of that environment, they treat you like an unwelcome visitor. Go to this church if you feel guilty that you don't go to church and want a minimal effort to check that box on your list saying you went to church that week, and expect minimal effort from the church in their efforts towards acknowledging that you attend beyond them cashing your check. This guy's going to be visited by the ghost of Christmas past, present, future. It's cold and unfriendly. The over 30 crowd can forget it at this place. It's run by barely out of college kids for barely out of college kids. Now, you can take that as a positive review, ladies. Because this person couldn't tell that you're old. If you are in the 40 and over crowd, expect strange stares from the younger crowd as if they're questioning why you wandered into their church. Do you get the sense he's projecting? Maybe he gets strange looks everywhere and thinks that's happening to everybody. Clicky, snobby, vacant of substance. I would have said bereft. But they will welcome your check. So, you never want to spend too much time answering your critics. And so I could go on and on about this pumping for money and this collection sometimes twice. In the 6 years I've been here, that's never even occurred to anybody. We've done it 4 or 5 times on a Sunday when we've been desperate, but never just twice. I mean, do it 2 times is so short-sighted. I could go on and on about how every week multiple people from Crosspoint serve in Durham at the Durham Rescue Mission. And the Christmas thing that we get to do with all of those hundreds and hundreds of people locally. And then the global things that we do, very specifically in Haiti and Kenya, and just what we talked about last Sunday. I could go on and on defending all of that, but I won't. And the idea of not being welcoming and clicky and all that stuff. But really, here's my main issue. Barely out of college. Like our one of our worship pastors today, Spencer, I could have taken him to my prom in a baby Bjorn. Like, I'm long out of college. And some of our elders, they can hide their own Easter eggs. They're getting so far up there. So I don't mean disrespect, just for perspective. Like, what? So the first one was like, yay, she's so with it. And the second guy is like, you kind of idiot. This guy's ridiculous, right? He's grumpy. If you go and look at, like I clicked and looked at other things he's reviewed, everybody in the triangle gets 1 out of 5 stars. He just hates everything. Walking around, boo. And so there's part of me that's like, man, I hope life gets better for him, or that he realizes life is way more beautiful than the 1 star he gives everything. But you know what humility would say? Did you catch that he said the other reviewer that talked about the church being clicky was right? You know, humility says, oh, you know, from certain perspectives, we do seem a bit clicky. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. One of them is, you know, that's kind of typical for big churches. The staff to congregant ratio is 100 to 1. 1 to 100. So that's kind of hard to feel like you can be intimately close when you're up against 99 other people per staff person. That's hard. And we recognize that. Humility, our best swing at it, says, yeah, you can't just dismiss it because you don't like it or because it sounded kind of pathetic. You got to listen. Is there truth in that? Yeah, there's probably truth in that. Now, some people on staff, I mean, we've got just shy of 30 staff people here, super gregarious, open, just can talk and talk and talk. Some of us on staff just aren't that way. And I'm not that way. And I've worked on it. It's a deficit of mine. I would really like to walk off this stage most Sundays and just go hide in the woods till you all left. Not for lack of love. I don't do well conversationally with people. I'm really happy when I've got just three or four people around me. So, and that's something I've wrestled with because I've been called to my face unapproachable. And rather than being offended, just, okay, I got to listen to that. I'm being perceived differently than maybe I perceive myself. And so you never let criticism shape you. That'll make you a performer. That'll make you very unhappy. You also don't let praise shape you. That also makes you a performer. What you do is you listen and you say, my perception of myself might be different than other people's perception. Am I willing to be humble enough to say, is there some truth in that? You all are clicky by some reviews. You know why? Well, it's because you get used to seeing the same people in your same row at the same time at the same coffee station out here. And when you see people that you recognize, you run to them. Hey, how you doing? You don't run away from them. Well, that's by some definitions a click. I know you. Let's talk. Other people, you don't know me. We have to work on that together, don't we? This is, if we're humble, we would say, it sounded a little ridiculous, but is there some truth in it? That's what humility says. Jesus is a teacher. He is a brilliant teacher. Now, there's different ways of describing Jesus, depending on where you come from, how you see him. Some people respect him in a historical sense. Some people do that. Plus, they see Jesus spiritually as still present, and it's mostly that, and some it's an amalgam of both. But what many of us we don't do is remember that he's a brilliant teacher. Like if you're sitting in a chair across from him riffing on society, psychology, people, how things work, it would blow your mind. He's a brilliant teacher. And it says in the Bible, when he's 12 years old, people three, four times his age were like, where did this kid get this? His insights and his questions on how these things work, religious, socioeconomically, religiously, all of those things. He's a mind-blowingly good teacher. And so he's always teaching. He's everywhere you see him in the Gospels, if you're watching, he's always shaping and reshaping thought. He's always, always teaching. He's always asking questions that make you ask two or three or four more questions. And you're, okay, my head's on sideways. I got to chew on that for a couple hundred years. He tells stories that are unresolved on purpose. So for thousands of years, people aren't entirely sure if there is a main point or if it's actually supposed to paint a bunch of different pictures, depending on which way you look at it. Brilliant, far more substantial than simply, I'm just going to dump some information on you and then you puke it back 2 weeks on a quiz. He's a great teacher. Of all the other ways of reviewing Jesus, he's a great teacher, which makes his followers what? Students. The disciples, you see disciple, and oftentimes you think of a certain kind of a man, maybe, in a certain kind of robe or a certain kind of religious person. A disciple is a student. Jesus would have been referred to as Rav, which is a respectful way of saying master, teacher. Or the more Aramaic slant, rabbi, my teacher. And so the followers of Jesus would have referred to him as teacher, as rabbi, as master teacher, which puts them in the position of a student, which in the Hebrew mind you would call a talmid. Maybe you've heard of a talmud. It's a teaching document. A talmid is a learner. So plural, add an im, talmidim. The disciples are talmidim. They're pupils of their teacher. That's what followers of Jesus are. They're students. And in the Greek, when it's translated disciples, it's a Greek word in the New Testament. It's martetes. It means the exact same thing. They're students. They're pupils of their master. They're in school learning from Rabbi Yeshua. This is how it works. Now, this plays out in a lot of different ways, watching Jesus interact with his students and other people who may or may not be entering into a student-master-teacher relationship. It plays out a bunch of different ways. Matthew 16 is very interesting to me. So if you've got a Bible, flip to the New Testament. First book is Matthew, 16th chapter. It reads this way. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his marthetes, his students, who do people say the Son of Man is, class? They replied, well, some are saying you're John the Baptist. Others say you're Elijah having come back. Other people, Jeremiah or one of the other prophets, you know, reincarnated somehow. What about you guys? Jesus asked. who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered, you are HaMoshiach, the Messiah, the anointed one that all Israel's been waiting for. Big loaded statement that. The Son of the living God. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. You nailed that. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. For this wasn't revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. Great insight. But let's just keep things in perspective. This was whispered in your ear. You didn't just divine this because you're that awesome. So he kind of humbles him a little bit. Let's keep in mind that this has been revealed to you from God. This was whispered in your ear. From that time on, Jesus began to explain, to teach his martetes, that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke Jesus. Never, Lord! You see how those two words contradict each other? This shall never happen to you, all-knowing master. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You're in my way. You're a stumbling block to me. You do not have in your mind right now the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. I don't know what you think of when you think of calling somebody Satan. Because I know you're itching to figure out when. Like, what kind of person, when is that appropriate to call somebody Satan? Like, what, by the music that they listen to, or the way they do their hair, or don't? When is somebody really satanic? Maybe a government person? When do you really pull that out? Jesus doesn't do this very often, and when he calls somebody Satan, it's typically among friends. Jesus calls somebody Satan when they hop out of the student role and into teacher role. Messiahs don't die, teacher. This is never going to happen. You're wrong about this. And Jesus says, whoa, the track that you're on right now, you being my teacher, saying never and then Lord in the same sentence, you correcting me but still referring to me as master, the track you're on right now is a disaster. You need to hush and get back behind me because this is exactly what ruins everything when the students pretend to be teachers. Now, 6 days after this, the very next chapter, Matthew chapter 17, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Just these three. Jesus takes just these three. Jesus said he was clicky. I'm still getting over it, apparently. And he leads them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured. Jesus is transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. And just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Now, the scholars have had a field day with this. You've got Jesus up the side of this mountain. He starts glowing. He's like, I can't look directly at him. Something is happening. And he says, like the sun. He's trying to describe what it was that had happened. And then all of a sudden, there's Moses and Elijah. And scholars generally agree that this is a great representation. When you say Moses in the first century Jewish context, you're talking about Torah, the first five books of the Bible. You just say Moses, you know you're talking about the law, the commandments. Elijah represents prophets. Kind of the rest of the story, the in and out relationship that the bride of God, Israel, they were aligned and then they were misaligned and then they're aligned and the prophets call them out. So when you say the law and the prophets, you're saying in their context, the Bible, what we now call in our modern connotation, you would say the Old Testament. But the law and the prophets was a way of saying the Bible. So Jesus is standing there with the whole Bible. And Peter said to Jesus, woo! Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'm going to put up three tents, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Now, Peter might like camping. That might be what's going on here. But some scholars say, you know, this word shelters is translated tents, that what might actually be going on is that there's this expectation that throughout the scriptures, the righteous will dwell in tents with their God. So it's a simplistic picture of living with God very simply and intimately with their king in their midst. I'm going to set up the tents. Righteousness is here. Jesus, I've got this great idea. While he was still speaking, so just imagine, Peter's still talking, his mouth's still going, there are still sounds coming out. A bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my son, whom I love, and with him I am well pleased. listen to him. Oh, I love Jesus, this is great. Okay, I'm going to put up the 3 tents, and yours will be the biggest, and then there will be one on this side. And what I'll do is I'm going to make it a, shh, listen. Listen. Are you listening? Listen to him. Peter, hush. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground. I love this picture of humility. See, they're close to the humus. I kind of forgot who I was there for a second. And they get down, they're terrified, they're startled. And Jesus didn't want to scare them, so he comes and he touched them. He says, get up, don't be afraid. And when they looked up, they saw nobody except for Jesus. And I think Matthew's being clever here. You've got Moses and the law and the commandments, and what do we hold over people, and what do we live by, and what are the codes? What survives from this faith into the new faith? And then there's Elijah and the prophets, and is this about something specific pertaining to Israel, and but not the Gentiles, and this whole thing? They open their eyes, just Jesus. Yeah, but what about, just listen, it's just all about Jesus. Now, if you're Jewish reading this story for the first time, or if you're one of these young Jews on the mountainside, this has profound implications because in the Hebrew dialect, the word listen is Shema. This, to this day, is a very, arguably, the most important prayer for the Orthodox Jew. It's one of the first things you learn as a kid. I've heard some people say that it's good if it's the last thing that you say before you die. So I don't know how that works if you're falling off a cliff, if you can get it out really fast, the Shema prayer. But the Shema is a prayer you recite over and over and over throughout your life as a way of aligning yourself with God and the faithful people historically. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Listen up, Israel. The Lord, our God, is one. That's how it starts. Listen to him. Shema to him. These Jews would have went, oh, this is a really historical, sacred thing that's going on right now. We often talk about the summation of the scriptures. Jesus has asked a couple times, hey, can you make the Bible more portable? There's 613 commands. There's all these do's, a whole bunch of don'ts. Jesus, how do you take the big maple tree and boil it down to one bottle of syrup so we can really kind of get at what's God's main point? And we know this. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love others the way you wish that they would love you. On this hangs everything. Jesus says this in a couple of contexts. What's interesting, though, is he tweaks it a little bit depending on his audience. And in Mark chapter 12, this is how he puts it, because it starts, one of the teachers of the law, somebody coming in from the perspective of, I'm a teacher. I don't ask things necessarily as much as I say things. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them, Jesus is in that lot, debating, noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer. So see, he's giving Jesus a review. He asks, I'm getting over it, slow but sure. He asks Jesus, so, of all the commandments, which is the most important? Now, it's not recorded here that he addresses him as teacher. Sometimes what's not said communicates a whole bunch. He doesn't address him as rabbi, teacher, or even sir. He just starts talking. Of all the commandments, which is the most important? The most important one, answered Jesus, is Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. That's how he starts. Then he says, you'll love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as you love yourself. There aren't any commandments greater than these. To a teacher that walks in the room to say things, to review, and to say, I already know what the right answer is. I just want to see if you do. Jesus' first words are you listening? Are your ears open? Because if I'm going to talk about loving God with all you got, the best you understand him, not somebody else's version, but really understanding God with everything that you really are and loving others the way you wish that they would love you, before you can do that, you're going to have to put down a whole bunch of presuppositions, a bunch of ideas that you come to the table with saying are already true, your stubbornness, your pride. You're going to have to open your ears and listen. Are you a student? Because that's what it takes. Listen to him. Jesus isn't just a sharp kid from the Galilee that had some really cool things to say. This is the Christ. Listen to him. This is the cosmic Christ that holds everything together. Not just the Jesus of Christianity. This is a Christ that's that supersedes even the confines, our mental confines of Christianity. He's the glue, he's the mortar, he holds all things together. Listen to him. This does not mean, I'll try to pay attention during a sermon. I'll give it a listen. Let me get finished doing what I want to do, and then I'll give it a cursory listen, and then I'll go back to doing what I want to do. I'll check it out. That's a great place to start. That's a terrible way to live. This is the Christ. Listen to him. You want to follow him. That's what it means. You listen to him. Paul, when he writes to the Colossians, this is how he describes Jesus. He says, "For in Jesus, everything was created. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, all things have been created through the Christ and for the Christ. He is before all things, and in him, everything holds together." Jesus is the glue, he's the mortar, he enmeshes and entangles everything seen and unseen on every level. It's all holding together in him, not even in our belief in him. That's actually happening far beyond the confines of our imagination, even beyond the confines of our understanding of our own faith. Listen. Are you listening? Will you listen? And not just listen to, but will you listen for? You understand, a Christ that can be found in and through in all things. The assumption on the student's part is that everywhere I go, I can hear him if I listen. You don't just listen to, but you're always listening for. You've got an ear to the ground to say, I know you all have said, oh, you're not going to hear Christ at maybe that place. You're not going to hear Christ speak there. You're not going to hear Christ speak in those people. You're not going to hear Christ in that particular belief. Maybe this one, but not that. No. The students of Jesus say, you realize he's always teaching everywhere. And I want to hear it. Other people have said this, but not this, that, but none of that. He's always, always, always teaching. Rabbi Yeshua is always teaching. And I don't want to miss it. But some of us, frankly, with good intent, but frankly, many of us were like defiant, rebellious kids who talk all the way through class, and we're missing it because we already knew. We've already made up our mind. And Rabbi Yeshua is speaking. The Christ is speaking. We can't hear any of it. We're backward. We're talking to somebody else. We're totally not listening. You're going to miss the whole thing. I don't want to miss it. Humility is the position of an expectant student. That's what humility is. I expect there's something for me to learn. That life and love himself is always speaking. Other people have said, you can't learn anything there. No, that's not important. No. I'm an expectant student. I'm always listening. And you'll notice the description of humility that I'm giving sounds a lot like wisdom, because I would say that they're two sides of the exact same attitude. Throughout the scriptures, wisdom is the goal. You want to become wise? You know the first thing you're supposed to do according to Proverbs? You want to become wise? Go get wisdom. That's what it says. Well, thanks for that. Go and acquire. Wisdom isn't the ability to answer everybody's questions and have all your own questions answered. That's not wisdom. That's pride. Wisdom is recognizing I get to always, always, forever learn. I'm always, always going to have a chance to hear Rabbi Yeshua speak and teach to his students. That's what wisdom is. And so wisdom requires humility and being humble. That's a very wise place to be. They're all wrapped together. That's why ideally you see people mature in their life and they get older, they get smarter, they get wiser, they get more humble. There's a gentleness about them. As their world gets bigger, as they take in more information, they become wiser, they become more humble. It's only young people or young-minded people who know everything and think they're stronger for it. Have you noticed this phenomenon? It's the neophyte that knows everything, that doesn't listen, and thinks that they're strong for it. And the older you get, they realize, no, that's less and less true. And that's making me more and more wise the more I realize that. A buddy of mine, he came back from university, and he said that the professor on the first day stood up in front of a chalkboard, and he announced to the class, when I graduated high school, I knew this much about the particular branch of math he was teaching. He drew this big circle. He said, when I got my master's in this branch of math, I realized I know this much. And he drew a cantaloupe-sized circle. And he said, I stand before you now, this guy's 50, 60-something years old, I stand before you now as your professor confessing, I know, and he just pokes the chalk into the middle. This is how much I know. And he said it was such an inviting thing that he did. Rather than saying, you're in good hands, I'm going to teach you everything about this. He said, this is a big world, and I'm going to humbly lead you into it. Let's see what we can discover. It's only the insecure, the young person that says, no, I'm not listening. I'm here to convey to others the best way to live. Historically, I have been a very bad listener. That's a true statement about me. As a young kid, I picked up for various reasons that to be in a position of learning, especially from people your same age, you never want to do that. That's weak. You always want to be the most powerful, and the most powerful is the teacher. And as a kid, I can remember exactly where I was in my elementary school arguing about where the fuselage was on an F-14. I was making up parts. And then I remember that the conversation went to the 9/11 Carrera. And I didn't know what Carrera meant, but I was certainly going to tell them how fast that car could go and which cars were slower. I knew nothing about it, but I couldn't for a second. And I remember this very clearly. I realized, why don't you just ask them? They buy the car magazines. And I wouldn't let myself ask any questions. I wouldn't do it. Now, many of us, we do that. And it's endearing because when you're young, it's cute. I held on to that. And suddenly I was graduating high school and going into college and then moving out west to St. Louis. And what I started doing, I magnified the stubbornness in a way that you could call an unholy deafness. I was not to be told anything. All the foundation that my parents had given me, all the wisdom, wasn't hearing any of it. I was willfully deaf. I wrecked myself financially. I was living on probably 150% of my income. Is that shiny? I'll have some. Is that loud? Yes, please. Is it fast? Two. That'd be great. Steve, you oughta. No, you oughta. And to keep it family friendly this morning, and as full a confession as I can give, I colored outside the lines of wisdom in every category. Use your imagination. Yes, I sprinted across that line. And people would say, Steve, it's not smart to. No, you're not smart. And I just kept going, shaking my fist, thumbing my nose. I'm going to do this exactly how I want to do it. Back off. And I was good. Like I said, I had a good foundation. My dad was a cop, so I knew about consequences, which the cop thing might have worked against me. I get that. Only thing worse than a pastor's kid, right? So, absolutely train wreck. There's worse, but it was pretty bad, the decisions that I was making. And understand, too, I'm a Midwesterner, so there was redneck influence in there. You know? So, and I mean that with respect, if you can believe it. Influenced by rednecks, and then I moved to big city aspirations. And I found out the hard way that when you move to the city, hey, everybody, watch this, it turns out different than in a cornfield. I can say with sincerity that some of my decisions and some of my indecisions, the foolishness, willful, unholy deafness, don't anybody tell me better, has consequences now, modern day. It still affects me. And there's good that has come from it. But there are a few negative side effects that I'm still paying for. And I don't for the young people in the room, that's not, the old people always do the cautionary tales. And you're going to regret it later. There is no later when you're young. I get that. But I'm saying that unholy deafness still, in some ways, costs me. So then there's this conversion story, and I'll spare you the details, but there was this demarcation where now I'm a Jesus follower. In so many words and in so many weeks, I said, I'm not a very good God of my life. I'm going to let the capital G one give it a shot, you know? And so I become a Christian. I become a follower of Jesus, and there's all kinds of cool things that came with that. But from unholy deafness, I was kind of holding onto a rope swing, and what I did is I crossed the line and swung all the way over into holy deafness. Have you ever met this person? Now, I'm stubborn, I'm angry, I'm judgmental, I'm critical, I'm narrow, but you have to listen now because Jesus agrees. The rigidity in me the stubbornness in me, the ugly judgmental attitude that I had. Now I had a holy deafness, which I would argue might be worse than an unholy deafness because now it's divinely sanctioned. I was the exact same person. I just had a Bible under my arm now. Exact same person. There was a conference that went on that had elective courses that I could take. And I took the one on evolution and creationism. Early on, I was one of these people that if you believed anything about evolution, I would vilify you, I would demonize you, I would call you a bad, immoral, I might even use the Satan word. That's who I was early on. Now, frankly, the only time I've ever done a scientific experiment was on Drosophila melongaster, the fruit fly experiment. You guys remember that? See if the white dot will rip. That's the only scientific experiment I've ever done. And I'm looking people with a bunch of letters after their name going, wrong. And I would have said, well, God told me. So, that's where I get my credentials, right? Heaven. So I was always reading and trying to find a way to vilify these people and not listen and shame them and talk about all these things. So I took this class that was, it looked like it was going to be really good, a really big class, and I was going to, man, there's going to be more ammo for my gun. And the guy comes out and he goes, I got to confess up front, this is a little bit of a bait and switch. He said that this whole thing has become very ugly, and so what I want to talk to you today about is loving people that disagree with you. Loving people that come out on a totally different side where the evolution, not evolution debate is, that we would be people of love versus people who are obsessed with getting our own point across and just not listening. He talked about the best thing that we can do for the kingdom isn't trying to win an argument that in many respects we're ill-equipped to argue, but that we would be good listeners, that we would love. And I was seething. I was so angry. You lukewarm piece of weak trash. So guess what I did? I spoke while he was speaking. And I corrected him and said, this is all well and good, and I get your point, but you are failing to account for Jesus himself said. And then guess what I did? I quoted scripture to him in front of all those people that doesn't exist. I made up a Bible quote, just like I made up parts on an F-14. Didn't even know I was doing it. This guy in total humility, you know what he says? Oh my gosh, I've never read that. Where is that? He's totally open to, show me where this is. And I was like, okay, and I crack open my Bible, and 10 minutes later, I've got beads of sweat on my forehead. Where the heck is this? Big turning point for me. Big turning point for me, because you know what? It was a holy deafness, which I could argue might be worse than an unholy deafness. Interesting story pops up in the Bible, which you can say that about a lot of sections, but check this out. In Mark chapter 7, says, Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre, and he went through Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee, and into the region of the Decapolis, the 10 cities. There are some people brought to Jesus, a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged Jesus to place his healing hands on him. So after he takes this man aside, away from the crowd, check this out. Jesus puts his fingers into the man's ears, then spits, and then touches the man's tongue. Like, if you're the Lord, aren't you thinking, they're never going to forget this? Like, I was thinking maybe the scribe wasn't there, so he's like, okay, they're never going to remember the words. I'm going to have to burn an image into their retinas. How about the... And he's touching the guy's tongue. So then Jesus looks up to heaven with a deep sigh and says, Ephatha. Which means be opened in Aramaic. So this guy is not just some Gentile. This guy is already, he's already kind of in the family. And at this, the man's ears were opened, his tongue was loosened, and he began to speak plainly. And Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone. This is a yet. Jesus saying, I know you're going to want to tell people. Don't tell people yet. I've got more work to do. If people think that this is why I came, my relationship with them is going to be chiefly pharmaceutical. Don't tell them yet. But the more he did that, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He's done everything well, they said. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. So here's my question. What is the first thing the man does after he gets his hearing? He doesn't listen. The first thing he does when his deafness is cured is behaves like a deaf person. No, Jesus. I know PR better than you do. Let me handle this. I'll throw in a Lord just so you can know. I'm on your team, but I don't mean it. He's not listening. This is my story, and I suspect maybe it's some of your stories. We swing oftentimes from an unholy deafness right into a holy deafness, and nothing really gets better, although the words change. All the while, we, each of us, we want our relationships to go better. Work, school, family, all in some measure, in one or more of those categories, we wish relationships worked better. We wish that the world was a better place. We wish that our lives were somehow better, that our interior world, the way that we think, we wish that it was better. We wish that certain circumstances, the way things just went better, and not just better on some scale, but just that they were good. We just wish that they were good, and yet we continue to be willfully deaf. And so some of us swing all the way from an unholy deafness into a holy deafness and can't figure out why Jesus didn't fix anything. But it also occurs to me that some of us are unholy deaf in one ear and holy deaf in the other, embracing things that are dark and secret, and it's a total integrity-wrecking kind of a thing that's happening in one ear, and in the other ear, they're deaf in a whole other way because they don't even hear themselves condemning other people's behavior in the name of Jesus or morality. And so sometimes what we're talking about is two different kinds of people, but sometimes we're talking about sawing a person in half. And on one side, you have an attitude that says, nobody tells me anything. I'm old enough now to know that if it sounds traditional, it's probably not true. Nobody's going to tell me anything, especially if it sounds old-fashioned. I will reject anything I don't like, especially that which sounds like it's from a bygone era. There can't be anything good in that. Do you know how many young people, and really all people, but especially young people, they do this with sex? You know how many times this gets justified to me? Well, I mean, we're committed, so we know better. They're shushing me. They're shushing their parents. They're shushing God. No. We've got it. That used to be an issue, but we've got it. We'd get commitment now. Totally deaf to the divorce rate. Totally deaf to the depression rate. All that. Yeah, we got it. We know what we're doing. Willful deafness. How many people do this with their money? Nobody ever calls themselves greedy. They know greed, and we live in a greedy society. And on average, people only give 2% of their income to somebody else. 98% of their own income they live on, and they shake their fist and say, why can't people be less greedy? What about you? No, I'm not going to hear it. You know, things are tight. Things are maybe next year. They won't listen. They will not entertain that there's another way to live. I know what's best for me. I know exactly how I'm going to live. My junk is my junk. And I withhold forgiveness, and I'll give it to you when you earn it. But I don't need your forgiveness because I didn't do anything wrong. That was months ago. Get over it. And I'm going to judge because I know that deep down I really am better than you. And I submit to no one, and I will submit to absolutely no one until they can at least assure me I get to keep some control. And then we have holy deafness, a whole other group of people that aren't listening. Say we refuse to entertain that there might be ideas outside of our sanitized ideas. We refuse to entertain that there might be something in between the very easy black and white world that we live in. This up-down binary reduction of complexity that we've embraced and said, that's what it means to stand firm in the faith. We don't listen to any other ideas but our own. If it's not our tradition, if it's not our interpretation, if it's not our take, we absolutely turn a deaf ear to it. It's a whole other different kind of opposite problem. Deafness on both sides. They cannot hear each other because they're deaf. Not because of a handicap, but because of a willful desire to remain a stubborn child. But both sides want the world to be a better place. Both sides want their world to be a better place. They want things to go better. And in the middle, you have Talmidim. You have students saying, we recognize that following Jesus means listening. It's not a bunch of statements. It's not an argument. In the middle, there's a student-master-teacher relationship. And we want to listen. Other people gave up on them. We're listening to them. They said she can't be trusted because she's the sum total of her mistakes from a couple years ago. Nah, every day is new. We're going to listen. We want to see that the Christ is still speaking in and through her, and we don't want to miss it. Some people say, no, you can't, from this whole philosophy, whether it be scientific or sociological, philosophical, you can't get anything good from that. But the student of Christ goes, oh, no. Christ is always speaking everywhere. I don't want to miss what he has to say there. Always listening, always on the humble assumption that Rabbi Yeshua is speaking if you'll recognize God gave you two ears and one mouth. That we would humbly sit at his feet and learn, learn, learn. Now, this makes you vulnerable. It's very hard to do because you never get to stop and just say, I'm done thinking. You always have to think because you're never done learning. There's always new things. You're always being challenged, contradicted. It's tiring. It's harder. Black and white's way easier. But it's the kind of people that God is inviting us to be. So maybe you're not in the faith. Maybe you're new to the faith. Maybe you've been around the faith for a while. And in your own words, you're asking, okay, this is how we're going to start the year off. But when are we going to get to the deep stuff? When are we going to get to all the other stuff about religion that man, this is a great thought, but what about all the other stuff? And I don't think anybody said it better than St. Augustine. He said it this way. Should you ask me what is the first thing in religion, I should reply that the first, the second, the third thing therein is humility. Because without humility, nothing's going to work. Nothing makes sense. May you go from this place with peace. May you go with the humility that expects the Christ to be speaking in ways that other people have already decided is impossible, isn't going to happen. May you go and be good students. And I will be speaking to the cool people up front. See you next week.